While many people all across the UK mourned the now inevitable prospect of Boris Johnson's Brexit, election 2019 wasn't all bad news.
The Westminster leader of the DUP, Nigel Dodds, knew the North Belfast seat he's held for 18 years had slipped from his grasp.
For the first time in Northern Ireland's history, Unionist parties failed to win a majority of Westminster MPs, returning just 8 out of 18. More significant still is the popular vote, where a breakthrough result for the Alliance Party meant just 42% of voters backed either one of the two traditional Unionist parties. As the DUP is also cast out by the Tories at Westminster, no longer dependent on their votes to get Brexit through, we ask whether Ulster Unionism faces a historic crisis.
I mean, unification when at this stage, I think, and that's shared by most of my friends, my age group.
You really think it could happen that soon?
I never would have said so. I mean, if you had asked me 10 years ago, I would have said it's a pipe dream, but these days, with the way Brexit's going, especially if they put a border up along the Irish Sea.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Joining us to talk all this through is Jane Wells, a Northern Irish curator, activist and community organiser, and long-time Irish immigrant in London, Joseph Healy, principal speaker of the Left Unity Party and a member of Another Europe's NC.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So, look, before we get on to what on earth is happening in the future of Irish politics, I thought it would be quite interesting to start with, you know, the life of the Irish in London of different generations, because it can't always be that easy, given that I often think, especially after we went there on the previous pod, you know, it really is a case of so close but yet so far. It's really not that far away. So many historical, colonial and also cultural ties. But there's so much ignorance this side of the Irish Sea about so much of that history. So I wanted to start there, really.
My earliest memory that I have of being in England, I was about 7 years old and my aunt had taken me and my wee brother to Centre Parks. And I'll never forget, I was in the changing room at Centre Parks and a lady was there with her daughter and she asked me where I was from and I said Belfast, and the look of horror that came over her face. She said, what's it like living there? And I, you know, wee girl, just like growing up there, had no idea that where I lived was a news feature in the place that I was visiting. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't abroad. As well, I was in England, still in the UK, and asking my mum and dad why, that it was a weird thing that somebody thought that I was from there. You know, and the attitude kind of rolls from that extreme to just complete ignorance. So I've lived in London now for 7 years. I came here initially to do an MA and I was looking at cycles of trauma and violence in Northern Ireland and really started to dig into some of what had happened in Northern Ireland and the relationship to the reporting here for the first time in my adult life, and started to kind of draw, you know, lines together and connect things and like these different attitudes and why that lady met me with that horror, because the reporting here had been so reduced to kind of tropes and stereotypes of violence. And, you know, the Irish is wild terrorists. And very little understanding actually of the British involvement in that conflict, or the really like the true complexities of the violence. And again, while I was doing like this research of my own, having to again and again repeat to my peers what happened in Northern Ireland, you know, that there was a conflict, no, it hasn't completely disappeared, that it's ongoing. And then, you know, more recently to be faced with people all of a sudden very interested and very excited to talk about the Irish border. Quite often, you know, that it's exploited in a way by Remainer friends who will exploit the Irish border in arguments to stop Brexit.
I remember that really clearly from the first conversation I had with a Remainer kind of cabal, and somebody saying the leaky Irish border is our secret weapon.
Yeah.
And I was thinking,
And you know, I think that that's hugely problematic, because I think, and this is probably something that goes across time, but particularly for Northern Irish people living in London, to arrive here, you know, and a lot of my childhood was really shaped by the conflict. To arrive here knowing so much about my history and my history in relationship to Britain, and to arrive here and have nobody know anything about it was a huge shock, and it felt like a real slap in the face.
Mm. And Joseph, you have a slightly different perspective here, because you're a longer term immigrant but also from the Republic of Ireland. So when did you first move to London?
Well, I came here in the 80s, and the bombing campaign was still in, you know, full flow, and there was still that very strong anti-Irish prejudice, which had lasted since Victorian times, really, and, you know, the Irish were still regarded as both dangerous and stupid. There were still anti-Irish jokes and all that sort of thing. And I found myself two occasions in the wrong place at the wrong time, because I happened to be in Brighton when the bomb went off in the Grand Hotel. And I remember thinking, being here as an Irishman, I'm likely to be picked up at any moment and sort of dragged off for interrogation. And I happened to be in a taxi going to Bishopsgate on the day when the Bishopsgate bomb went off. And I remember the taxi driver stopping and talking to another taxi driver and saying, there's just been a massive explosion. And I thought, oh God, you know, again, being in the wrong place. And there was a constant fear then amongst the Irish community, probably similar to a lot of the Muslim community today, that at any time you could be picked up on, you know, various grounds and whatever. I mean, I wasn't directly involved in Republican politics or anything like that, but there was just a common fear amongst Irish people. And I remember people would refer to Southern Ireland, which only exists in the 1920 Government of Ireland Act. There's never been an entity called Southern Ireland. Most people didn't know the difference between Northern Ireland and the Republic, and until very recently, still didn't. So I had to constantly explain that, no, I wasn't British. I had an Irish passport. I came from another country. And I used to find that quite incredible, that people had learned nothing about this, really, in their history.
That does illustrate also just, I guess, how much has changed. When I met Mickey Brady in Newry when we were making the podcast, I mean, his description of life in Newry in the 1970s compared to life in Newry now, I mean, it couldn't have been more different. He was describing a countryside under complete military occupation. There is lots of progress that has happened there that we need to sort of keep hold of in what can sometimes be quite a negative story or discussion.
That's actually 5 decades, right, since the 70s. So it's the surprise is not the progress. The surprise is, as you say, this complete failure to kind of imbibe any of the history into a British understanding of its own place and its own relationship with Ireland. But I think specifically in the Brexit context, that has been experienced experienced with shock by Irish people living in England, that nobody realised quite how feckless and ignorant the British political discourse overall was. And I felt from a long time ago that that would ultimately drive the reunification of Ireland, because it's very hard to feel strongly that you're part of a body politic that doesn't really acknowledge you as a distinct political presence. Mm.
I think in Northern Ireland, you know, Brexit really confirmed for a lot of people that Northern Ireland is not an equal speaking subject. Yeah. In the United Kingdom, Brexit really felt for a lot of people like a true colonial act of power. You know, the voices in Northern Ireland were not going to be respected, and actually had the most to lose. Damning thing.
Had the most to lose and had already lost so much, in the sense of there were kind of certain illusions about equality, about political equality, and then they were really traduced.
And that's at the heart of the crisis of Ulster unionism in a way, isn't it? Because one of the noticeable things we've seen over the last few years is that it's often been DUP politicians on Brexit Party platforms and conferences coming out with this most crazy rhetoric.
I feel like I'm in a home from home. I believe that we're blood brothers and blood sisters.
While at the same time, you know, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland have clearly got so much to benefit from this mutual existing economic relationship. They are the same island and have to find a way of working together and having some kind of relationship. So there seems to be like this sort of gross contradiction between, I don't know, the mindset of a part of the DUP at least, and maybe wider in Ulster unionism, and the kind of reality, because they're not being listened to by Westminster either. So it does seem to have this kind of existential crisis, because if there's no one in Westminster supporting what they're saying, then where do you go from here, or what happens next?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that the leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, I mean, obviously they're hoping to benefit from the problems of the DUP, made a comment, you know, during the election campaign that we were so busy watching the Irish nationalists that we forgot about the English nationalists. And, you know, my background is a historian, and there's an interesting echo here from the speech that Edward Carson gave in 1921. I mean, there's a large statue of Carson outside Stormont, and he's seen as the great, you know, unionist hero, but in fact he came from Dublin, and he was the prosecuting barrister in the Oscar Wilde case. He gave a speech in 1921 after the partition of Ireland, saying that, you know, the British Conservatives had basically betrayed the Unionists for their own purposes, and as a sort of warning from history there, I think the Ulster Unionists have forgotten.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, you must be very pleased to see the DUP lose seats in this election. It was a strange election in that way, if you're Scottish or Northern Irish. It was more contradictory than if you're part of the English left like us, right?
Such mixed feelings the day after the election. I mean, a deep sadness here that, you know, the reality was that it looked like Brexit would then go ahead, mixed with pure joy watching the results come in at home and really see not just the fall of the Democratic Unionist Party, but also the really big swell in voters who are not split across green and orange lines. For someone of my generation, it feels like the tide is finally turning. Like, I haven't said this, but I was 14 when the peace process, when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. And so I was really that first generation of young people who were told to like look forward and into a new future. And to see voters really kind of come together along that way and just see that that's not a way forward anymore was really exciting. But the DUP really dug their own grave.
Do you think they dug their own grave by their coalition with the Conservative Party, by their confidence and supply, or just by their general behaviour?
I think that's where it started. It started with the DUP going into the coalition government. It then, you know, there was a hangover still from the Cash for Ash scandal. It then continued when, you know, the public services at home were just continuing to go under without any support at home. Voters, DUP voters, just had a total sense of abandonment, I think. The ERG wouldn't listen to the DUP, and the Precious Union just really didn't feel so precious anymore. And they just got walked all over, and everybody saw that happen.
But I think also Left Unity is a part of the European left, and we have links with Sinn Féin, and I had met with Sinn Féin people some months before the election, and I was aware of the strategic decision not to stand candidates in certain seats in order to cause maximum damage to the DUP. And I think that was seen as a historic move because Sinn Féin effectively stood aside for both Alliance and the SDLP, which allowed, you know, those Remainer parties, if you like, or anti-DUP parties, to take seats. And it was commented on at the time that the Remain Alliance, if you like, in Ireland was effective, where the Remain Alliance in England wasn't. And people couldn't believe that it was actually the Irish who were taking the decision, you know, to form a working alliance rather than the people here.
Because I looked up some of the data on the Alliance Party, and it does seem to be, notwithstanding the fact that they were helped by other parties, it does seem to be pretty incredible, like, results. So in 2003 Assembly elections, they got 5.6% of the vote, and now, 16 years later, they've got 17% of the vote overall. And it looks, and crudely looking at the data. So a lot of traditional unionist voters basically switched to the Alliance Party. And that does seem sort of very significant moment.
But don't forget the Sinn Féin's votes went down as well across the board, 6.7%.
But they went down because they stood back their candidates, presumably.
Not necessarily. I mean, the Colm Eastwood's win in Foyle was historic, and he won with 17,000 votes. And that was a historically very safe Sinn Féin seat.
And in his acceptance speech, Eastwood linked it to representation at Westminster and to the crisis facing power sharing.
We heard you loud and clear. We know you want someone to go to Westminster to fight your case, to stand up to Boris Johnson, to protect us from Brexit. But you also want us to get back to work in Stormont. No more excuses will be accepted by the people of our city or the people of Northern Ireland. Let's get back to work.
From the way that I'm looking at it, the DUP lost a lot of confidence from their voters. They had pushed a pro-Brexit stance from the beginning. Yeah. During the Brexit referendum, they pushed for a Brexit vote but had no clear plan or vision for the border. And, you know, I think that was one of the beginnings, but they, you know, voters in Northern Ireland for 3 years at the point of the general election have been sitting with two parties split along sectarian lines who were unable to get together and actually make public services work for Northern Ireland. So I think on both sides there was a collapse.
So to move on to the Irish Assembly, because that's the other big news, because the main effect of this result in a way by, as you say, defeating the two sides to some degree, DUP in particular, kicked the DUP basically back into the power sharing agreement on almost the same lines of the deal that they had previously rejected. So Northern Ireland now has a government again, so that's a really big positive outcome for the voters who cast their votes the way they did back in December. And there were set to be assembly elections. Now, from what I understand, five parties are now participating in the Northern Ireland government. So how's that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, the agreement that was reached, I forget what they called it, a new decade or new opportunity or whatever. I mean, some of it was quite farcical. And it showed a sort of tit-for-tat attitude because the Irish language, I mean, it's, you know, Gaelic is recognised in Scotland and Welsh in Wales, but, you know, the Irish language had no recognition whatsoever because of the DUP resistance. But in order for the DUP to be able to sell this to its supporters, you have a commissioner for Ulster Scots, which to my mind is like, you know, it's a sort of dressing on the cake to give them the impression that, well, we're giving them this, but we're getting this in return. And I think the other major weakness in the agreement was the petition of concern.
We did cover this briefly, but you can activate a petition of concern, like give us a bit of an explanation on what it is.
Yeah, it's in the Good Friday Agreement in order to ensure that one community doesn't, you know, ride roughshod over the rights of another. So if there is an issue which is seen as causing, you know, major concern to the other community, then it can be activated, which will mean that any legislation will be blocked. Now, what happened was the DUP had used that in order to prevent equal marriage and abortion rights, which was, you know, in my mind, a misuse.
Yeah.
And there was an attempt in the new agreement to make it that one party alone couldn't trigger that, but unfortunately that remains the case.
Right.
So I could see that becoming problematic at some point, possibly around something to do with Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, it is super cynical, isn't it? Like, to have a prescription that is basically designed to stop a civil rights scenario against one community being used to block human rights is pretty gross.
Talking more broadly about this being the end of the road for the Unionist Party, is if we say unionism is over, is it necessarily true that reunification is on the cards? Or is that too much of a leap?
I don't think it's immediate. I think that there are huge lessons to be learned from Brexit and how quickly everybody rushed into that without any idea of a plan. I don't think that it's a simple answer of reunification. The Ireland and the Republic of Ireland as it exists. It wouldn't be simply a matter of, you know, consuming the North into what that looks like now. Mm-hmm. Though, you know, and I think that the Republic would be wise enough to have those conversations in a real way beforehand.
Presumably it needs more though than just the kind of disintegratory pressure of what's happened in the last election. It needs some kind of active enthusiasm. And is that enthusiasm there? Is that enthusiasm there in the Republic of Ireland?
Well, I think, you know, from there's a programme on at the moment in BBC Northern Ireland, which is a comedy called Mind My Head or something like
Give
that.
My Head
Give
Piece.
My Head Piece. And there was a joke in that in the last season that there were six letters that would prevent Irish reunification, and they were DLA and NHS. And there's a certain amount of truth in this, in that the Irish Health Service is in meltdown and has never had a proper public-funded health service. A lot of people are aware of this in the North, and I see this, you know, particularly I'm thinking in terms of maybe moderate unionists who this would be very, very concerning for them that any future reunified state wouldn't have a public health service and things like that. But I think, you know, it's interesting that the opinion polls in the South, in the Republic, are showing the majority of people favour reunification. Now, I think there are caveats around that. I think there are two major concerns, and I was over in Dublin recently talking to people, and they were saying, you know, one is the cost factor, the reunification cost. There's an old joke that the Irish Republican dream is that the British leave, but they leave a blank check on the mantelpiece. That is, you know, that would be the idealised situation. But, you know, Northern Ireland would need huge subsidies. And it's been costed that it would be about 15% of the GDP of the Republic. Now, there would be concerns, obviously, from a lot of people in the Republic about that. The other issue, I think, is the danger of a sort of unionist romp who wouldn't accept reunification, and we could have some sort of Bosnian-type situation where the Irish army would then have to intervene and all the rest. There's always been that sort of fear at the back of people's minds. Mm. I mean, personally, I don't think that danger is as real as it was, say, in the 70s when the Ulster workers' strike brought down the power-sharing agreement and the power-sharing government and all that. Mm. But there are still, you know, the unionists do try and trigger this fear every so often. I mean, they were saying it recently about the part of the Brexit deal with the border in the Irish Sea, that there could be unrest and violence in the streets and so on. They're aware of the impact that this has, and I think that is a real fear, I think.
Yeah. I would say certainly to not underestimate that threat as well. It's not reported here, but there are terrorist incidents in Northern Ireland. But I think, you know, we can talk about the Democratic Unionist Party and their fall from grace, but, you know, that's not to say that unionism is necessarily dying a death. And I think that English nationalists might be the greatest threat to unionism. For Ulster unionists to watch English nationalists push them aside is really, it's a bit of a shock to the system.
How do we think that the new power-sharing assembly, I mean, are they going to come to some kind of consensus about what they want from Brexit?
Isn't the clue in the name, though, Brexit? The term Brexit really annoys me, because it's not Brexit that we're talking about. It's not Britain leaving the EU. It's the United Kingdom. And actually, that's something that I find like really actually insulting when I hear English people talking about Brexit, is just ignoring the fact that it's not just Britain leaving Northern Ireland or being dragged out with mm-hmm. them. And actually, maybe that is the answer. It's that like Britain makes that hard exit and Northern Ireland has that softer option and the border in the Irish Sea, as it's now commonly known.
Yeah, and you can imagine that happening.
I think it's very problematised by Scotland, though. I mean, if Scotland were pro-Brexit, then Northern Ireland could have a kind of backdoor special dispensation and everybody could go, OK, that's fine. But if every concession that Northern Ireland gets, Scotland's going to want.
If Britain / England wants a hard Brexit and Scotland doesn't, and Scotland wants independence, it raises this crazy question of a hard border in Britain, i.e. the Scottish-English border. God, you know, how on earth do you get that? It's almost like Brexit is an impossible project that is sort of doomed to failure.
Yeah, and that nobody thought about any of this beforehand. That's the most infuriating thing. You know, and it's almost like the peace process had done so well that all of this complexity was completely invisible here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost like a failure that nobody thought actually that one, the peace might be fragile, and two, that the border would be something that actually people would still care about.
For me, the takeaways when we went to Northern Ireland is that the peace process did kind of create special status for Northern Ireland that is talked about now in the Brexit deal in a way that already exists. You know, you have this relationship between the Republic of Ireland and the UK that, okay, it was never called sharing sovereignty, but it looks a little bit like sharing sovereignty, you know, with the citizenship stuff, with like a role for the Republic of Ireland in some Northern Irish decision making. And, you know, in some ways it's a kind of generational status quo that suits a transition. Maybe sometime in the future there might be a united Ireland, but at the moment is probably the best that could be achieved for all its problems. Brexit, in the name, British exit, brings that completely explicitly into focus, that Northern Ireland is not like Britain. It has this special status.
But you asked about the role of the Assembly, and I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that most of the parties in there are Remain parties. And, you know, they will want good relations with both the EU and the Republic. And to go back almost to the agreement I mentioned earlier, it's a bit tit for tat, I think, because the DUP concentration will be on the border in the Irish Sea and ensuring that there's minimal barriers to trade and contact with Britain, whereas I think the nationalist parties, on the other hand, will be looking at minimal damage to the relation with the Republic. So I think both sides really want a more fluid situation. But I think, you know, the direction of travel really is going to be some sort of European Union type territory. I think that's where, you know, and one of the problems the DUP has is that it alienated the farming community and a lot of the business community and so on by taking the position that they took on Brexit. And I think they're going to, you know, for their own benefit, with more assembly elections coming in 2021 and so on, they're going to have to sort of revisit, I think, their whole approach to this.
Anything else we want to say?
So much.
You know, final thoughts.
I mean, we haven't really like touched a lot, I think, on, and I know you've already done two podcast episodes on Northern Ireland, but you know, I think it's the really like my role in like coming to see you initially was in, I really, really in a way enjoy talking about Northern Ireland now to English people. And I didn't when I first moved here. I think part of that has changed because there's a real interest now and actually an ability to be a bit more complicated about the North and, you know, not reducing it to conflict. A part of what's happened to me living in London is that I found an Irish community living here. I work with other women on abortion rights for the North of Ireland, and that has been an amazing, like, to work with English female politicians, in particular with Stella Creasy, who has really taken an interest actually in what our own government was not able to do for us. And I think the more that we can talk about those successes, the better, and not just like lose everything that Northern Ireland has built, you know, over the past 20 years to Brexit. And yes, it will dominate and impact people's lives in the North in a way that it won't here. But I think we've got too much to lose, and there's a real like renewed sense of vigour and holding on to all of that in the North now, especially with the Alliance Party, where people, I think, will really be prepared to fight.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. It's not been an easy few months for the left anti-Brexit community, but we're not going anywhere, and we promise to bring you lots of hope and inspiration in the years ahead. You can support the podcast and the campaigning activity of Another Europe Is Possible by signing up as a member. Just go to anothereurope.org/join. Members also get access to extra time on the podcast as a benefit of signing up. In this week's extra time, we asked Joseph about the upcoming elections in the Republic of Ireland. He explains how the idea of a united Ireland has emerged in this discussion in quite an interesting way. See you next time. Bye-bye for now.
So there are also elections, I know you follow closely, coming up in the Republic of Ireland. What do we think about them, and how will like Brexit play out in that election? And isn't there lots of talk from Leo Varadkar and people that have raised the idea of a united Ireland, which seems quite unusual.
A year or two ago, talk about united Ireland would not have been on any agenda in the Republic, and now it's become commonplace. But it's interesting that both Fianna Fáil, who described themselves as the Republican Party, and Fine Gael, both putting out, you know, very strong messages that we're not looking at unification anytime in the near future, and, you know, this would be too big a step for the Republic to take and so on, which is causing enormous anger to Sinn Féin and so on. Now, of course, Sinn Féin, having got back into the Assembly and so on, are running, you know, a campaign in the Republic as well, and of course we could have a situation, a lot of the talk in this election has been who will be in any potential coalition, and the view amongst most Irish journalists is that it will be a Fianna Fáil government, and Fianna Fáil are more open.
Just that's, they're the opposition at the moment, say Varadkar.
Well, opposition in parentheses, because there's been a very strange setup in Ireland where you've had a Fianna Gael government with the opposition voting through government legislation.
Oh, okay.
So there was a deal done between Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil, where Fianna Fáil basically said, we will give you stable government for several years, as long as you sort of clear it with us. So there's an element of farce in this election, in that people are saying, well, you know, you've been supporting this government's programme for the last 4 years or whatever, now you're standing as the major opposition. And also this government officially included a number of independents. So we had a Fianna Gael government with a number of independents backed by an opposition, the main opposition party, going through. So Sinn Féin and the Greens are expected to do quite well. They're presenting themselves as the real opposition rather than the sort of fake opposition.
But so would Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil be centrist parties, would you call them, kind of broad centrist parties?
So centre-right, really.
Centre-right.
Both of them.
Yeah, I mean, they're founded really on the origins of Civil War politics.
Right.
And that brings up another interesting issue, which I was discussing earlier with Jane, which is about the centenaries. I don't know if you're aware, it became a big issue in Ireland, is that since 2016, they've been celebrating the centenaries of 1916 and 1919 was the beginning of the War of Independence and so on. And this year, the Fianna Gael government decided, rather unwisely, to hold a commemoration event for the Royal Irish Constabulary. And the role that the Royal Irish Constabulary played in the War of Independence was basically they were fighting against the IRA on the British side. And of course, the notorious Black and Tans auxiliaries were a part of that force. And the government decided to hold an event to commemorate them. And they tried to sell this as reaching out to the unionist community and reaching out to the history of, you know, the other side in Irish history and the British side and so on. There was an uproar. Mayors of many towns, cities, refused to attend the event. Historians denounced the event and so on. And Varadkar came on television to say why he thought it was important to defend it. But in the end, they withdrew it. And it was a very salutary lesson, because it showed that Irish history is still a very live issue. And when politicians go near it, they have to be very, very
careful. Can I ask, just for a bit more detail on that idea of what kind of politics are forged by a kind of civil war, by a civil war history? Because do you mean, in a sense, that people shy away from radical differences between each other, because there's a kind of collective memory of how bad.
No, I think that historically people based their support on which side your family was on in the Civil War.
Okay.
But I mean, that has become, you know, as time has moved on, generations have changed, has become less and less relevant. So ideologically, the parties are very similar. You could say, very broadly speaking, that Fianna Fáil was traditionally the party of the small farmer, the small businessman, whereas Fine Gael was seen as the party of big business and large farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a certain class difference there. But, you know, I think they're by no means left-wing in any sense of the word. I think the only left-wing parties really fighting this are Sinn Féin, and there are a number of other smaller parties. And it's expected that the Greens will do quite well. So the whole question in the election, after the election, will be who's going to form the coalition. And
so is Leo Varadkar unpopular in the Republic? Because he has this quite flattering international reputation, but you're saying he's about to lose. Go on.
I think it's very interesting. The reason why they've called the election now is on the back of Brexit. And Varadkar is selling his team as we're the winning team. We've managed to negotiate a good Brexit for Ireland, and Brexit isn't over, and if you want a winning team to continue, because if you look at the other side, they would make an absolute mess of it. And the other issue, of course, is the Stormont Agreement, where again the Irish government played a central role. So he's going forward using these two, what he sees as political achievements, to sell his government. But on the other side, there are huge issues around the economy, particularly homelessness and health service, as I mentioned, which is in a meltdown, and issues, you know, around poverty and inequality. And of course, if they become the dominant issues, then Fine Gael will be in serious trouble, I think. And of course, Sinn Féin and the left are going to try and make them as big an issue as possible.
Interesting.